Yeah, okay.
Is Nancy here?
Yes, she's right behind him.
You good to go through?
I mean, right now, I think it's important.
Call the House Committee on Healthcare to order. We're going to go a little bit out of order to make life a little easier for some of our colleagues with a busy schedule. So I'm going to open up two public hearings and a work session just to take testimony from a member of the House, and then we'll close those and go back into the proper order. So I will open a public hearing on House Bill 2368 and House Bill 2371 and ask Representative Nathanson to come forward and testify on those. For information, then I'm going to open up a work session on 2378. Follow that.
Thank you very much, Mr. Chair. Mr. Chair and members of the committee, I'm Nancy Nathanson, State Representative from District 13. House Bill 2368. Lots of attention and discussion is given to access and expanding access to health care. I think it's just as important to pay attention to reducing the cost of health care. Overuse of health care services is frequently cited as a major driver of health care spending, and in some cases, excessive ordering of certain procedures, such as MRIs and CT scans, can be harmful due to overexposure to radiation. So we're talking about cost, and we're talking about health of patients. This bill directs the Oregon Health Policy Board to establish a work group that will investigate and develop recommended strategies for reducing the number of unnecessary advanced images that are ordered. Please notice that there is an amendment that I hope you will consider as well, which will clarify when a report should be made. And we have also just recently today submitted a letter from Pacific Source Health Plans. The Annals of Medicine in 2009 published an article entitled, What a Texas Town Can Teach Us About Healthcare. One of the points that caught my eye was this, quote, costlier care is often worse care. Well, that's a pretty extreme thing to read. Atul Gawande went on to explain that the primary cause of that town's high cost was, quote, very simply, the across-the-board overuse of medicine. This is a disturbing and perhaps surprising diagnosis. Americans like to believe that, with most things, more is better. But research suggests where medicine is concerned, it may actually be worse, end quote. Earlier this month, the American Academy of Orthopedic Surgeons released results of a study involving 72 surgeons who tracked more than 2,000 patients in office visits, emergency rooms, and other settings. It showed that about one-fifth of those tests that bone and joint specialists were because a doctor feared being sued, not because the test was necessary. And you may have read in the February 2011 issue of State Legislatures magazine that I think all of us receive about accountable health care. Quote, savings may come from better preventive care, management of chronic diseases, and coordination of care, all of which may require fewer expensive tests and treatments and eliminate waste and duplication, end quote. Radiation exposure increases the risk of cancer and genetic damage. In 2005, even, the Journal of the American College of Radiology reported that a third of imaging studies are inappropriate. And a 2007 New England Journal of Medicine study reported that 20% of cancers in the U.S. would be attributable to CT scans. This is alarming. Again, it's about risk and health as much as it is about cost. We know there's been an increase in the use of advanced images, expansion in the number of imaging centers, an increase in certain cancers, and physician and policymaker concern about defensive medicine. Without pointing fingers at anyone, without trying to jump to conclusions, and instead focusing only on reducing cost and improving patient outcomes, let's ask for a good group of people to put their heads together and report their conclusions and recommendations. Imaging is one of the many cost containment topics directed to the Oregon Health Policy Board to study. Further, the Oregon Health Policy and Research, or OHPR, staff recommends imaging appropriateness as a target of study. It's identified by the National Priorities Partnership as an area having potential to result in substantial improvements. The use of advanced imaging is both a cost issue and a public health issue. This bill just simply says, let's get to work on it now. Let's roll up our sleeves and start to do something about it to reduce cost and reduce risk. Thank you.
Do you have an amendment to this, did you say?
There was, yes.
Would you comment on the amendment?
Oh, the amendment is to clarify that a report would be due at a specific time rather than just leave it open-ended.
Great. Any questions or recommendations? Yes, sir.
Maybe I'll just add a story, the opposite story. You'll recall that a year and a half ago I shattered my shoulder, and I had one heck of a time getting an MRI. Three visits to emergency brought x-rays that showed nothing, and 3.5 weeks after the accident I finally got an MRI, which immediately showed very severe damage and resulted in a modest 10-fold increase in pain medication. Because now they believed me. So it's a tough issue. When is overutilization and when is underutilization?
Mm-hmm. Mr. Chair, I just want to recall Senator Westland's story about, I believe, 6 MRI machines in the community of Bend, Oregon, with its relatively small population, and concern that that raised for him, and I think for all those who are, many of those who are working on healthcare transformation. I share with Representative Nathanson my support for this type of bill as attempting to get at what's really driving costs in healthcare, which in my view is how we practice it. In a hospital or a physician invests in a piece of equipment, very expensive piece of equipment, and needs for it to be used in order to pay for it. And I think that has resulted in some overutilization, although, as Representative Kennedy points out, when you need it, you really need it, and you're glad it's there.
Ben solved the problem by just doubling its population. Representative Nathanson, we have also 2371 open, so go for it.
Thank you very much, Mr. Chair. Last year, our local newspaper reported an incident that troubled me. It said that 20,000 households in my area had one or more people who would need to be revaccinated. This is quite a big story. I thought, 20,000 households, what's going on? I was concerned about the impact on children and adults who had received the vaccine. What did this mean for cost? What did it mean for families who would have to, maybe someone has to take off work, maybe use public transportation or borrow a car, maybe it's not easy to go back to get revaccinated. I thought about all that time and trouble for both the families and the healthcare providers to revaccinate everyone. And of course, since I do have some interest in ways and means issues, I also started thinking about the cost. Well, now, wait a minute. What did this cost? What did it cost the families? What did it cost the providers? And what did it cost the state, if anything? So I made a few phone calls and started asking questions. There's a cost to the family, of course, the cost of taking time off work, the transportation. There's also the potential risk. So I decided I wanted to do something to help avoid this from happening to the greatest extent possible in the future. Storing vaccine isn't like storing your nasal spray or cough syrup on the shelf. There's a very narrow range that's appropriate for storing vaccine. With this bill, the Oregon Health Authority would adopt rules that require clinics to ensure that their staff have access at no cost to education about the safe storage and safe administration of public health's greatest accomplishment, vaccines. This bill will also require that clinics that receive vaccines funded by the taxpayer to efficiently account for their use and care of the valuable product. And by the way, let's recall, it's not only the cost of the product, but sometimes in times of shortage, you can't just order up a replacement and get another vaccination if it's in short supply. The Oregon Immunization Program provides over $35 million worth of vaccines to hundreds of clinics across Oregon using a combination of federal funding sources, including the renowned Vaccines for Children program. The program contributes to frontline prevention of serious illness and death. Private and public clinics are very busy places. In many, staff lack access to the appropriate kind of information about how to store the vaccine. I'd like to share you a few little facts that I've learned. In 2000 alone, more than 60,000 Oregonians needed to have their immunization repeated due to very poor storage of vaccine. This wasn't one isolated incident. It happens in many places around the state, and it affects thousands and thousands of people. The medical errors from poorly stored vaccine in 2009 cost public and private providers an estimated $9.4 million in unrecoverable costs, plus an additional $500,000 to replace the actual vaccine. We're talking real money there. Refrigerators for vaccine storage must maintain a very narrow 11-degree range. Too cold or too warm can make the vaccine useless. The Oregon Immunization Program will take advantage of free web-based educational programs that clinic staff can access at any time of day. This isn't a matter of someone having to take a day off work and travel hundreds of miles to take a class. Any time of day, this is going to be available. Staff will spend 1 or 2 hours to learn about the best practices for stewardship. Many clinics have already implemented educational requirements for their staff. This bill will exempt those agencies from the state's web-based training requirement. The state immunization program can implement both accountability and education requirements with existing resources. That's what they tell me, and I trust them on that one. This is a fiscally sound bill. It will save money by preventing future revaccination programs. My interest in this started out as a public health issue, and I am really pleased to present this to you with an idea that it also will save money and increase efficiency. It makes it easy for clinics to get access to the right kind of education at no cost, and it will ensure protection of our communities to continue their good work toward preventing serious disease in people of all ages. Thank you.
Are there questions? Representative, thank you very much.
Thank you.
We'll close. As soon as I can find my agenda, we'll close the hearing on 2368 and the hearing on 2371. We'll be back to them in their proper order. We'll open up a work session on 2378 and ask Representative Sheehan to join us, please.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members of the committee. I want to disclose a conflict of interest.
Your name first,
oh, I'm sorry. I'm Representative Patrick Sheehan. I represent House District 51. And I want to disclose a conflict of interest. I have an advertising agency that one of my clients is one of the two companies in Oregon that would be affected by this. And I apologize for the rushed nature of my testimony and request. I just spoke with him just a few minutes ago. So it's a very gory, strange industry to consider cutting up a cadaver and mailing pieces of it across the country for surgical training. But it's a very useful, important thing. And this industry has existed for a long time. My client's interest is in making sure that we don't follow the Wisconsin model, which is where now in Wisconsin, only the university system may deal with this type of tissue. So his company actually does all the things that this bill suggests and wants to do, all the record keeping. I know because I've helped him market this. And he's concerned that the exclusion of OHSU puts a foot in the door to outlaw the industry. So that's his primary concern. This is an interesting industry, to say the least. Definitely offers a benefit both to trained surgeons and other medical professionals and their craft, and also provides a more inexpensive type of way to get a cremation if you're a family member that's stuck with the expenses of a funeral. So it's a good industry. I don't know that it requires the sort of regulation right now, and certainly the OHSU exclusion gives me a lot of cause for concern. My hope would be that you might be willing to put it aside for a couple of weeks and let me get you some more testimony and some more information. He's certainly not against the idea of licensing. He thinks it adds credibility to the industry, but would just like to have a say in it, and I apologize that I didn't make him aware of this any sooner. My involvement with other committees kind of prioritized those things. So,
questions or representatives?
Can I ask you? I'm not sure I understand why the exclusion of OHSU, and there's an amendment to exclude other hospitals from this.
That's my concern too, Mr. Chair. I would be every bit as interested in knowing what happened to Grandma if I was dealing with a private company as I was dealing with OHSU. Record keeping and all that's very important. So that's my concern as well. Okay. So thank you.
Representative Thompson?
It's my understanding that part of the issue is the dismemberment part. As OHSU, if you will your body to them and it's used in anatomical teaching, you get the body back. In some of these other programs, if you will your body or sell your body to them and they dismember it, whatever they have left over is cremated, but your feet might be in New York and your tongue is in Tahiti, and it's
not
very
my,
hard.
Not my golden tongue.
I won't go any farther than that, but
maybe that's sufficient.
Once you've been distributed, you might not fit back together well. So that was one of the distinctions.
Yeah, it's just I don't understand why the concern is that. I understand why OHSU might be exempted. I'm not sure what the concern is with it. Thank you.
Mr. Chair, Mr. Co-Chair, I believe that all of that material is returned, at least with this client of mine. I've seen their facility in the back. They actually keep, and this is gory, so forgive me, but they have the large freezers for when they first get there, and then they have a standard, like an icebox that you would keep in your garage with each donor's name, and as they get the pieces back, they go back into this piece for a final cremation. So that's my understanding, but I'll get clarification on that if you'd like it.
We had some testimony that not necessarily all the pieces came back in the right order in some of the instances. That's what started the concern.
Interesting. That must have been that other company.
I have two questions. The first is, how many people do these companies, do your client and the other companies that you know of, how many people do they employ here in Oregon?
Mr. Chair, Representative Hoyle, I believe my client is BioGift. By the way, the other one is MedCure. And I believe BioGift probably employs a dozen people here in Portland.
Okay.
And it's mostly administrative.
Okay. My second question is your concern that the exemption of OHSU and the other hospitals, that it would be setting up an unfair advantage because there would be a different set of standards, therefore a different economy of scale, a different structure, so possibly putting them at a disadvantage in terms of pricing and ability to compete?
Mr. Chair, Representative Hoyle, I don't know that that's as big of a concern for me as just the possibility that they could be excluded completely, that this could lead to that. I don't know that they're worried about price competition or anything like that. I mean, if they're competing on price and aren't able to get it done, then the market sort of decides. I don't know that the OHSU model of not keeping records would contribute substantially to being uncompetitive. But I could get that information for you. I could ask.
I'd be interested to know to put up having the work session to find out what the issues are.
Wyden, did you have a question?
No, I support Representative Boyle.
Okay, thank you very much.
Thank you very much.
We'll close the work session on House Bill 2378. And go back to the top of the agenda and start over.
Mr. Chairman?
Yes, sir.
May I ask a question about that? So are you going to postpone it, or
well,
what's your intention?
What I'll do is let's get to it, and we'll talk about
okay, thank
what
you.
We want to do. We'll have some discussion. Yeah, we had planned on working it today, but let's see what the, okay. what the interest of the committee is. Open up a work session, I mean a public hearing on House Bill 3018. Sandy, what have we got?
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, this House Bill 3018 is a carryover from Friday's meeting, the 25th.
Yes.
This requires the health benefit plan to reimburse an enrollee for tobacco use cessation program only after the enrollee has completed the program and ceased the use of tobacco products for 12 months.
Do we have anybody to testify?
Well, we had some on Friday. I believe Phil is Phil was in the room.
Back there.
And so I believe he returned. We have a new individual, and then I don't know if Dr. Hedberg made it back today. But Eric
Sweet,
is here.
Can
Eric.
We?
Well, you can call my recommendation, Mr. Chair.
Oh, yeah.
Erica
Hagedorn.
Phil, and then Stephanie, if that's acceptable.
Come on, it's wonderfully acceptable.
Okay. And I do have their testimony from Friday that I will pass out now, both from, actually, I don't have all three of them, but I do have Phil's, and I will be passing out something from Dr. Hedberg, who wasn't able to return. We do have a little paper.
Whatever order.
Thank you. Co-chairs and members of the committee, I'm Erica Hagedorn, here today on behalf of Pfizer. We want to respectfully oppose House Bill 3018 today, and I'll explain briefly why. Pfizer worked with a large coalition of healthcare providers last session. Pfizer is one of the largest healthcare companies in the world, and in the interest of full disclosure, we do have a smoking cessation drug on the market. But in the interest of working with our other healthcare partners, we worked to support and pass Senate Bill 734 in 2009, which provides a $500 a year benefit for smoking cessation covered under private health plans. We feel that House Bill 3018 would gut the intent of Senate Bill 734, which we feel is one of the only tools available to smokers that is more of a carrot than a stick in an effort to get smokers to quit. So if a smoker chooses to quit and they choose to access this benefit, then the benefit is available to them. I handed out a letter from an employer in Portland for you to outline sort of the importance of this type of benefit to smokers. As I'm sure many of you realize, that when a smoker tries to quit, it's proven it takes a couple times for a smoker to actually kick the habit. So we want to make sure that they have the opportunity and the ability to be supported in those efforts. That's all I had today, and I can take questions, but I'm sure my partners here will have comments as well.
Questions now? Leader? Okay.
Chair Greenleaf, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Phil Donovan. I'm here on behalf of the American Lung Association. We're a member of a task force, the Helping Benefit Oregon Smokers Task Force, which is a group of healthcare providers, advocates, health insurers that are working to implement Senate Bill 734. And it's our belief that, as Erica pointed out, that this is a rollback of Senate Bill 734, which does provide cost-effective health insurance benefits so that Oregonians can end their tobacco use. Setting aside the challenges of probably administering this kind of legislation, because as we're all really aware, tobacco is a tremendously addictive drug. And some people stop smoking for a short period of time and then restart. Sometimes it's a year, sometimes it's a couple years, and then they restart. So So there's concerns about how this would actually work if you were to pass this legislation. And frankly, it's our hope that even if somebody fails in their efforts to quit smoking, that we'll support them trying again. So with that, we respectfully submit our opposition to this, and you have our testimony.
Thank you. Any questions, Mr. Donovan?
Yes.
I know you're speaking in opposition of this, but tell me whether I need to hold my question. The question is, how would you know whether somebody smoked within 12 months? I mean, I've smoked for 25 years and went through a smoking program, and I don't know how you do it. So I guess that's a question maybe for later on, or do you guys know?
Well, Chair Greenlick, Representative Doherty, I mean, your question is exactly what we pondered as we considered this legislation. And so I think that is, you're speaking to the difficulty of administering this kind of legislation.
Yeah. I didn't think you could answer it, but it was.
I don't think the opponents are going to help you get an answer to that question. I don't think the opponents are going to help you get an answer to that question.
I didn't think so. Yes.
Chair Greenlick, members of the committee, my name is Stephanie Thomas-Sweet, and I'm the Director of Government Relations with the American Heart Association in Oregon. And I'll just keep my comments very brief in saying that we're also opposed to this bill. We're involved in Senate Bill 734, and for the reasons that you've heard referenced prior to myself, and I also just included with my testimony a one-pager from our national office that just talks about the economic benefits and the human benefits for anyone who quits smoking, and so we urge your opposition to this bill. Thank you.
Thank you. Any other questions? Thank you guys for carrying over. We ran out of time.
You're welcome. It was time well spent.
Close the public hearing on House Bill 3018, and open a work session carried over from Friday again on House Bill 2967. Madam Administrator, do you want to talk to us about this?
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, House Bill 2967, you will recall, relates to patients requesting the results from a clinical laboratory. We had the bill before us earlier last week. There were still some questions about the amendment, what's before you, and I hope everybody brought it or still has access to it for Friday, are the -3 amendments. Mr. Chair, you'll recall you worked with legislative counsel. The -3 amendments breaks it out into two different categories of the patient. Once the patient requests a clinical lab, they shall provide it to the patient in writing, the results of any analysis or examination immediately if the results have been available to the lab for at least one working day at the time of the request, or within one working day after the results become available to the laboratory if the results were not available at the time that the patient made the request. And it's all within the one working day. And we do have our fiscal and revenue on the -3. There's a minimal expenditure on the -3 and no revenue.
Okay. Why don't we take a motion on the amendment, and then we'll open up the floor for discussion.
Mr. Chair, I move that we adopt the amendments to House Bill 2967-3, dated 2/23/11.
Representative Thompson moves we move the -3 amendments to House Bill. Need to stay focused here. 2967. Is there any discussion on the amendments? Is there any objection to the amendments? The amendments, the -3 are added.
Mr. Chair, I move that House Bill 2967-3 is amended to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Representative Thompson moves House Bill 2967 to the floor with a due pass recommendation. And what? As amended with the -3 amendment. Is there any discussion on the bill?
Mr. Chair. Is there an enforcement piece to this, or is this aspirational, or
I think it's aspirational. You remember, this is an addition to the, it's making more exclusive the 7-day.
Yes.
It has whatever enforcement that we have with 7 days, which I think is also aspirational.
Companies that can't do their work shouldn't be doing business.
I think it's to give labs the right to do this. I think they don't think they had that right before.
What was that?
The original concept was that they would have to go back through the position, and they could when we first
did
this bill.
That point went right over my head.
That was last session.
Yes. Okay, thank you. I hadn't put that piece together. So this authorizes them, at the request of the patient, to give that information directly.
Yep.
Whereas before they would have had liability had they done that, because they weren't authorized. Thank you. That helps.
Any other discussion? Please call the roll.
Representative
Parrish?
Aye.
Representative Boyle?
Aye.
Representative Weider?
Aye.
Co-Vice Chair Cannon?
Aye.
Co-Vice Chair Kenmore?
Aye.
Co-Chair Thompson?
Aye.
Co-Chair
Greenland?
Aye. Motion carries. Do you think Jensen will?
Yeah.
Let's ask Representative Jensen to carry the bill, please. And we'll close the work session on House Bill 2967. And open a public hearing again, reopen on House Bill 2368. I think we have only one witness on this one.
No, we have three.
Okay.
You want to call them up?
I would. Will you tell us what's going on?
I would.
Again? One more time?
Yes.
And we'll ask Darren Kaufman, Thomas King, and Katie Riley.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, House Bill 2368, as you just refresh your memory, Representative Nathan spoke to it. It directs the Health Policy Board to convene a work group to investigate and develop recommended strategies for reducing the number of unnecessary advanced imaging tests. It sunsets The work group is directed to sunset on January 2nd. I have 2103. I'm thinking it's 2013. Sorry.
2103.
Yeah.
That's a long sunset.
That is really long, Mr. Chair. And I believe we're on 2368, and we do have the -1 that she mentioned briefly, that the board would be directed to report its work group findings to the appropriate interim legislative committee July 1, 2012.
Okay. You pick the order.
Okay.
Dr. Riley, Issa.
Chair Greenlick and members of the committee, thank you for hearing me today. My name is Dr. Katie Riley. I'm an assistant professor emerita at Oregon Health and Science University in the Department of Public Health and Preventive Medicine. But today I am representing the Oregon Public Health Association, OPHA, and we are coming today to support this bill. We are very concerned about the high cost of health care, particularly for low-income people, because it affects their access to good health care. And so this bill helps to address that issue. The cost of health care is being driven up by many unnecessary tests, such as magnetic resonance imaging, or MRIs, and computed tomography, or CT scans. And the costs have been twice the rate of other technologies in the past 2 decades. So it's very important that we really address this issue. There is a wide range of costs depending upon the location of where the tests are given and also the type of test that's done, but the average cost is about $2,000 per test. Many times it's been shown that these costs are unnecessary, the tests are unnecessary. For instance, studies have shown that in low back pain, it is better to have non-invasive measures such as exercise, heat, use of non-inflammatory and pain medications rather than surgeries, and that these can be determined to be efficacious rather than having the scans done through looking at different guidelines. In emergency rooms, the use of...
It said the indication for back surgery is having an MRI.
That could be. In emergency rooms, the use of imaging has tripled over the past decade, just in the past decade, with no increase or in the diagnosis of serious problems, so they're really not needed. And in addition, there is a great potential for harm on the basis of imaging with repeated imaging and exposure to radiation, as particularly for pediatric patients who are developing, and the exposure to radiation can be definitely harmful in terms of exposure for their young developing bodies. However, we are not opposed to the use of imaging. The scans can be helpful, as Representative Kenemer pointed out. They can pinpoint problem locations and help in terms of specifying where surgery should be done. And they can also prevent unnecessary surgeries by showing when, you know, it's really not indicated. Some guidelines for using imaging have been developed by professional organizations, and research is still ongoing. So, therefore, OPHA's position is that it's useful to have a work group to take a look at the relevant research that's happening, the guidelines that are in place, and as they change, what they might be, and then developing recommendations that would cut down on costly procedures. I would be very happy to answer any questions you might have.
Thank you. Any questions? Representative Kenemer?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. A couple of times I've heard about excessive radiation, and I'm wondering what kind of frequency is that associated with? And you said it was more of a concern with younger patients as well.
Well, some people would might have to have repeated scans, and there is a risk there of potentially causing cancer, and it depends on the situation.
We don't have numbers associated with that.
I don't have particular numbers, no.
Anybody else want to comment on that?
Chairman Greenlick, Representative Kimmer, my name is Thomas King. I am board chair of the Oregon Board of Medical Imaging. I'm also a registered radiologic technologist, and I work about four blocks from here. There is actually measurements now because most of medical imaging is digital. And I'm also assistant radiation safety officer at the place, and we're taking it very seriously that every image that is taken on a digital machine has the ability to record the dose. And in some states, like recently in California, have required that the dosage levels are kept in the medical record, and I wouldn't mind seeing if we could keep a cumulative lifetime dose on the patients, because a lot of people realize if you don't see it doesn't mean it doesn't happen, and that once you get your dose, you have your dose, and it adds up and again. So from the board's perspective, we want to make sure that the operators are operating these, are competent to operate the imaging devices. But as far as looking at dosing overusing, there, I'm saying that there is some technology available now, and with the advent of HIPAA and going to electronic medical records, there is now new ways to collect data.
Chair, so is there any standard, I mean, you know, like in dentistry years ago, particularly when they had much higher doses of radiation with their x-rays, there were recommended intervals and that kind of thing. Is there anything like that for MRIs?
Well, MRI is...
And I guess they vary in the technique used, no?
Chair Greenlick, Representative Kenemar, as far as MRI goes, that is a non-ionizing exam, so there is no radiation.
There
is some other issues with besides that, but the CT, the computed tomography, seems to be the big issue, and the defensive medicine being practiced appears to be an issue, and then but there are new machines out there, and with new American College of Radiology guidelines, in which 2012 the federal government's going to require most imaging centers to receive Medicare, Medicaid funding are going to have the what we call ACR accreditation. There are some guidelines about how those machines are operated and what kind of exposures. And so operated properly, an exam is always a benefit-weighted ratio as far as whether you should do them or not.
Is that your testimony? You want to go on with your testimony that I just answered? Please go on.
Okay. Chair Greenlee, all I was going to say is that as far as the board goes, we're available if there's any technical needs. As far as the health authority wanting to collect data, we're here to assist. We don't take a position one way or another, except that we want to promote safety and proper utilization of imaging.
Great.
That's it.
Any other questions?
Yes. Could you comment a little bit? I'm a little concerned about what the health authority would gain by doing this. Sounds to me like there are things on track to better understand and better utilize these techniques. If the concern is defensive medicine, if that's a motivating concern, then that sounds like we need tort reform more than we need a study group on this. How do you see this coming together? I mean, I'm great on appointing committees. I think committees are wonderful. You know, it's a great way to stall. But what do we really get for having done it and the cost of having done it? What's your anticipation?
Well, maybe the Oregon Health Authority can probably outline that a little bit.
Anyone can speak on that. I just
from our perspective.
Okay.
From our perspective, Chair Greenlick, Representative Thompson. There is data available. I should let the committee be aware that there is a movement in the federal level for around this line as far as proper use of medical imaging. It's in the early stages in the federal level, but I see that coming one way or another. So we get a statewide data. But I'll tell you, most of the major institutions now who are digital are looking at this already.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Darren Kaufman. I'm director of the Health Services Commission with the Oregon Office for Oregon Health Policy and Research, and here today representing the Oregon Health Plan. I should mention that the Health Services Commission recently put in place a guideline on the use of MRI for the spine, and can happily report that it does go farther than just if whether or not a person has a back or not. So we certainly think that this
chair is wrong.
Well, he didn't say I was wrong.
We certainly think that, you know, there's certainly much more that can be done in this area. We think that the bill is moving in the right direction, and we'd be happy to work with the sponsor and the stakeholders to make this a better bill.
Yes, in fact, the issue is not whether the MRI is the problem. The issue is what criteria there are to use MRI findings. And when I was working with the care management program at Kaiser, we found that the official MRI criteria for back surgery would have had 50% of middle-aged men who were asymptomatic would have qualified for back surgery on the basis of the MRI findings. So it's just how you use them is the real problem. And sometimes it's just wonderful. Are there any other questions in this panel? Thank you all very much
for
being
here.
Close the public hearing on House Bill 2368 and open up the public hearing on House Bill 2371.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, House Bill 2371, again, Representative Nathanson spoke to it just a little bit ago. This bill requires organizations that purchase and administer vaccines to certify that the employees have completed an Oregon Health Authority approved at no cost online training session on the storage, handling, and administration of such vaccines. This has an emergency clause. It's effective on passage. This has a subsequent referral to Ways and Means by prior reference, Mr. Chair.
Thank you. Okay. Let's start with Betsy Meredith, Dana, and Zachary Thompson. After that, we'll have Joy Wright, Catherine Bradley, and I think Michael Becker. Is that right, Michael? Is this the bill? Okay, that'll be the second group. Go for it. Introduce yourself, please.
Good afternoon, Chair Greenlee and members of the Healthcare Committee. My name is Betsy Meredith. I'm a communicable disease nursing supervisor at Lane County Public Health. I'm here to address House Bill 2371, the Vaccine Stewardship and Medical Error Prevention Bill. While the Board of Commissioners of Lane County has not yet had an opportunity to review and vote to support this proposed legislation, I'm taking this opportunity on my own to provide you with the information about our experience in Lane County. Immunization against vaccine-preventable diseases is one of the most effective public health success stories, period. But this success depends upon multiple factors in the vaccine product itself, in the system, and in the people that manage and provide it. To know if a child is protected, information about immunization status must be current and readily available to the patient and to the healthcare providers. If current information is not available, a patient may be given a vaccine they've already had and don't need, and this is a poor use of an expensive resource. If the records are not accessible, a child may not receive a vaccine that they need and therefore be unnecessarily vulnerable to a vaccine-preventable disease that may be circulating in the community. House Bill 2371 addresses gaps in the essential need for current immunization records by requiring that any immunization provider who receives state-supplied vaccine report all doses administered to the alert IIS data registry. As a clinical supervisor in Lane County Public Health in a busy clinic, I can tell you that this information is absolutely critical to making decisions and providing children with appropriate services. Like all counties in the state of Oregon, we've recently completed the school immunization review process. 60,000 records in Lane County alone of school children were reviewed for accuracy to be sure that their records are up to required standards for reportable or for vaccine-preventable immunizations. So complete information on the Alert IIS system from every immunization provider is essential. Vaccine is an expensive and fragile resource. To work, it must be maintained in the optimum condition until it is given to the patient. If it is not stored, monitored, and inventoried as required, the result may be subpotent vaccine, which does not provide optimum protection or provides an unknown level of protection. When the vaccine management error is discovered, expensive campaigns must be waged to revaccinate the children. As you are about to hear, kids, parents, doctors, and health clinics hate it. More importantly, public trust in immunization efforts may be compromised. While the responsibility for ordering and providing vaccination falls to doctors and nurses and other health professionals, the task of managing the vaccine and reporting and recording the shots administered are often delegated to unlicensed assistive personnel. In the best of clinics, these folks set up a system with checks and monitoring capabilities that assures that the vaccine received by the clinic is stored and managed and reported effectively and accurately according to the education and direction provided by the Oregon Immunization Program. But this responsibility can be especially challenging in private medical clinics where the staff who are charged with the vaccine management and data entry may change frequently. Training may be incomplete and backup systems in case of power outages or staff absences may be overlooked. Over the past several years, a number of private clinics located in Lane County have experienced preventable vaccine losses as a result of not adhering to required vaccine storage requirements. The Oregon Immunization Program is readily accessible to any clinic that needs this training, but all too often a clinic realizes its errors long after the vaccine has been compromised. Finally, House Bill 2371 would address this gap by assuring that at least two employees with vaccine management responsibilities receive state-provided or approved training at least every 2 years. The training requirement isn't onerous. It can be done online. It will save expensive vaccine and it will prevent a lot of frustration, anxiety, and time loss. It's a best practice for healthcare clinics and will allow providers to assure that parents, when the decision to administer a vaccine is made, that the child will be receiving the safest and most efficient product. Thank you for the opportunity to present this information to the committee and for your consideration.
Thank you. Any questions? Okay. Thank you. Thompson?
Do you
represent Master Thompson?
What? He called you Mr. Thompson. Okay. Dear Representatives Mitch Greenlick and Jim Thompson and members of the committee, REHB 2371 Vaccine Stewardship. I think that Bill 2371 should be passed because shots cause pain to my body. Pain equals stress. Stress equals no public peace. I am sure I speak for kids everywhere when I say we don't like shots and to get them over again is not okay with us. Please pass this bill so I never have to get more shots than necessary for a healthy life. Thank you. Zachary Thompson.
Thank you.
Thank you very much. Any questions of the witness? We can ask you hard questions now.
Yes. Yeah, I ask what charity is.
We have a question.
Representative Widener.
I hate to break it to you, but when you get older, you still don't like shots either.
Representative Kenimer.
And what grade are you in?
Fifth.
Okay. Thank you.
Good job. That was a hard question.
Well, he got the answer right, I think.
Thank you very much for your testimony. I think that's an important point for you. You know, when we talk about laws, they always seem dry and there are lots of words, but we know that there are people behind these, and the testimony as you just gave is very important to our process. Thank you.
You're welcome.
Mom, you on?
Yes, I am. Dear Chair, Representative Greenlick and Jim Thompson and the other committee members, I am here to talk to you once again as a parent. I have three children, and in 2009, I was given a letter saying that all three of my children received subpotent egg vaccines.
Hmm.
And I took the letter very seriously. I scheduled another appointment. I went down to the clinic, and I was talked out of getting them revaccinated. I have since then turned around and changed doctors just to be closer to home, and my new doctor will not even subscribe or give flu shots to my children because he feels the vaccines are that important and the flu shot will interfere with them getting vaccinated again. So I have to schedule more appointments again for my children to get their vaccines up to date. I have two younger children than Zachary here, and my two younger children all have to get six shots each and repeated over two visits. Zachary here has to get four shots repeated over two visits. This is not an okay situation for my family. It takes time out of my schedule. I am a daycare provider, and I affect 10 other families directly. These 10 other families are seeing what I am going through as far as revaccine, and they're questioning why they're even being vaccinated. It has had a very big ripple in our community for this revaccination. And the time it takes for me to take off of work as well as taking the children out of school is not okay for something that should have been preventable. Vaccines are the health field's greatest accomplishments. They do great work for the children, and they keep them very, very healthy, and we appreciate that. But it's silly that we can't keep people trained that can keep these vaccines in the proper amount of temperature that they need to be, but yet we spend all this time and money and even media coverage on keeping food safe for us to eat. And as a daycare provider, I do have to have a food handler's license. I've been through classes. I've had to take time off once again to do those. And the fact that the Oregon Health Authority is willing to do these classes online so people don't have to take time off to do this is a wonderful opportunity for them. And it just makes this bill so easy to represent and be done, and so that we don't ever have to go through a revaccination again. The benefits of a healthy society far outweigh the cost of revaccinating our children because of improper procedures that were not followed. Oregon Oregonians are choosing a healthier lifestyle every day, and we shouldn't have, we should make it simpler for the children and make it so that their lives are not full of pain when they don't need more shots than they already get. Zachary here has already received in his small lifetime 24 shots, and now he has to go and repeat 4 more of them. So I ask for your help in preventing this for future children, that they don't have to go through more shots. Thank you very much.
Thank you. Questions? Yes.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Do you know what caused the vaccines to be subpar?
The clinic that I went to said that they were refrigerated in a non-safe realm. As to whether it was too cold or too hot, I don't know. But they said that the OAH was overreacting, and that I shouldn't really worry about revaccinating.
Maybe we'll ask Ms. Bradley when she gets here to talk about that. Representative Cannon?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I appreciate the real-life perspective that you bring to this. And as the parent of 2 young children, these shots, and was it Zachary?
Yes.
Zachary spoke to it. And it is a big deal. Like, I think it's easy to sit up here and think, well, shots, we all had them, we were kids, we got over them, we're healthy now, they protected us from some bad stuff. But having taken my daughter to the clinic for these, it's a challenging, not just afternoon, but it can be a challenging afternoon, evening, and the next day. And we also were the, victims of subpotent vaccines last fall. We chose not to get re-vaccinated in that case and just took our roll of the dice with the flu that year. My question, and it might be for you, is what confidence can you give the committee that the training requirement here would be meaningful? I guess I begin to get a little concerned when we adopt state, and this in a whole bunch of contexts, where we adopt a state mandate for training, but then it's training that, you know, and I think many of us have been through professional development type scenarios where, okay, click here a few times and boom, you're done. You've learned what you need. But how much has really changed about my practice as a result? Can you inspire some confidence that this will actually change practice? Are there models out there that we can look at and say, yes, this is what the vaccine handlers will need to do?
Well, Chair Greenlick and Representative Cannon, thank you. I will try to inspire that. I'll do it by using the example of Lane County Public Health, where I'm the supervisor of our vaccine program. And we take our staff through this training every year online, and we are able to actually help train other clinics to do that. We have tremendous support from the state at our fingertips and at our call if there's ever a concern. We have a temperature monitoring system that alerts us 24 hours a day if there's any problem in terms of the temperatures. We have a backup system for where the vaccine goes to. All this we learned from the Oregon Immunization Program's training process. So we have taken these steps, these trainings, with our own staff, with our own vaccine, and it works.
Great. Thank you.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Can we call the next panel, please? Where were we? Joy Wright, Catherine Brady, and Bradley, and Michael Becker.
And while they're coming up, Mr. Chair, I want to acknowledge that I believe you all received a hard copy of testimony from Providence Medical Group on House Bill 2371. They wanted us to identify it for the record, and the letter is in support of the bill.
Thank you. Yeah. Identify yourself.
Good afternoon, Mr. Chair and the committee. My name is Joy Wright. I'm a registered nurse practicing with a large medical organization in the Lane County area. I've been practicing pediatric nursing for 25-plus years, and I am a strong, vocal advocate for vaccinating children from deadly vaccine-preventable diseases, adults as well. During the time I've been in nursing, much has changed in the vaccine world. The greatest changes are new vaccines being developed that protect children from even more diseases. the change in how vaccines are preserved and stored that my colleague spoke about, and the beginning of the Federal Vaccine for Children program initiated by President Carter. From my perspective, the Vaccine for Children program in Oregon has evolved and grown since the early days and has become a great leader in the vaccine storage and handling knowledge and information area. And as we've all learned, that they're talking about having this online program. I work with that large medical organization I told you about, and I should say to Zachary, I too am have been affected by a subpotent vaccine, and doggone it, I had to get revaccinated also, and I hate shots still as well. And so it's really important that we address this and the costs involved. And in this large organization I work with, we take great pride in the quality of care we provide our patients. We believe our vaccination processes have ensured patients who receive our vaccines are immunized against the disease, and that is because of the Vaccine for Children program and the knowledge that they have provided us. We work hard to be good stewards of the vaccine in our clinics and to meet the standards of the Vaccines for Children program. Last year, after a temperature excursion, meaning the temperature was out of range, we had a relatively small number of patients to revaccinate, although one, as Zachary shared with us, is way too many. Our organization recently spent more than $150,000 in upgrading to new lab-grade refrigerators rather than food-grade refrigerators, and we're about to implement a computerized temperature monitoring system that will report any fluctuation 24 hours a day. Thus, the cost will continue to rise. Prior to spending these dollars, our organization just broke even on the vaccines we administer in the private setting. The cost for this new equipment had to come out of our organization's reserves, and this was financially burdensome given the economy, but we were happy to do it to protect our community. The however I'm going to throw in here is the more difficult the rules become, there's a great risk that physicians and physician organizations may back out of the Vaccine for Children program or not offer vaccines at all. This is happening on the East Coast quite a bit, and this would greatly increase costs at the state and local level. I personally would be very concerned that many would not get to their local health department to get those vaccines, which of course would be devastating to our to the health in our communities. The economy of the last several years has been very difficult for everyone. Physicians and the medical groups they practice with have not been immune to these difficulties. If you choose to pass House Bill 2371, please know this must come with the dollars needed to support the bill that's proposed. If not, I have grave concern immunization programs will be dropped at private medical clinics with the consequence of all costs being shifted to the public health departments and the rate of vaccinations dropping. I encourage a partnership and balance with the Oregon Vaccines for Children program and private practice physicians. It has worked for the group that I work with.
Questions? Ms. Bradley? Oh, I'm sorry.
Chair Greenlee and Thompson and committee, my name is Catherine Bradley. I'm the administrator for the Office of Family Health, which has the immunizations program. You have testimony in front of you, and I am here today to speak in support of the House Bill 2371. Many of the points that we have in our testimony have been covered earlier. I think I want to talk to a couple of things specifically. Number one, this request that comes before you today in this bill in regards to the training is a result of a quality improvement process approach. As we've looked at these sort of issues, we recognize it's not the individuals, but it really is the systems, and what can we do to address things systemically in terms of looking at things differently. A second point that I think is important to know is that really over 80% of our providers who provide vaccine here in Oregon are private providers. So this is largely how do we really support our private provider population unless our public health system population that we have a little bit better management over. The issue of education and the variability of what we run into, we've been tracking for a number of years. Our state program is actually required every 2 years to visit every practice and to evaluate and assess the competency of that practice and also to talk with them about how how well they're doing within their immunizations. We also have refrigerator recordings that are sent to us on a monthly basis, and we do a random sampling of them. So we have a pretty strong understanding of the variability that occurs, the systems that have not been in place, and the backups that need to be there. We're moving increasingly to a little stronger area of technology, which is great. I can honestly tell you, I remember when we checked to see whether the vaccinations were safe, was we'd have a little paper cup in the freezer section of the food section of the refrigerator, and a penny would be in the cup. And if the penny was still at the top of the ice in the cup, then your refrigerator temperature was correct. If it had dropped, there was a problem. So I can tell you, we've advanced beyond that. But the fact that we now have refrigerated systems, we have different kinds of refrigerators, we've used funding this last year and a half that we got through H1N1 to educate, to also improve the refrigeration systems that we had statewide. All of those things have been addressed on a number of different levels. This education piece really is critical. We're trying to find out how to do this in the least onerous way, to do standardized education, to have practices understand the backup systems they need to have in place, and most specifically, what to do when there's a variation, because the challenge is less that they do not, they note the variation. The action that follows is what does not often occur. We're willing to work with practices that have systems in place, and many of our larger systems do, but this, I think, will assist us with that. The second part of this bill I do want to remind you of, and just make sure you're attentive to it as well, is that we are asking that all providers report to the immunization system. Over 92% do right now, but our ability to move ahead and standardize our processes does require that we need to have everybody who's able to do that. We had a lot of challenges this last year when we had H1N1. We actually went from approximately 600 providers to over 1,500 new providers because we had so many people that needed to be partnering with us in terms of really vaccinating our populations. So we also had to put a lot of education into bringing those providers online, and in these areas like the refrigeration systems, how to educate them in terms of what they needed to do differently than what they had before. So again, we're trying to address this from a quality improvement standpoint, from a system standpoint, from an efficiency standpoint. We do believe that there's not a fiscal implication on this because it can be incorporated in existing work and will be offset by the implications of what we're having to spend annually in terms of working with clinics to revaccinate their clients. Thank you.
Thank you. Any questions?
Well, we have Hoyle, Parrish, and Thompson.
Hoyle, Parrish, and Thompson. Let's go ahead.
My question is, you said that 92% of mm-hmm. people that are giving vaccinations are part of the program and are doing the reporting. Yes?
Representative Greenlick and Hoyle, yes.
Where are the other 8% and why are they not reporting? Are they because they're smaller practices, or are they in rural areas, or what? Or is it that they're just not hooked up to the system? Where are you finding that other 8%?
Chair Greenlick and Thompson and Representative Hoyle, thanks for the question. In fact, Oregon has a voluntary registry system, and the fact that we are at 92% with a voluntary system is considered to be pretty unique in the country. Yeah. It's not just simply smaller or more rural practices, but it is the variability as we bring on new providers that they have to learn our systems. And until they're really engaged in that, there's been a little bit of a loss of time with that.
Perfect. Thank you.
Thank you. Two questions, kind of a two-part. So if I'm a someone who can give vaccines and I take this course, does that follow me from employer to employer? I'm specifically thinking pharmacists, because we had the conversation, I think, last week about pharmacists and giving vaccines, and those folks change jobs, you know, locations, and they go from Safeway to Fred Meyer's, and they kind of bounce around. So I'm curious how if that works, like the OLCC, where I get to take my service provider permit from restaurant to restaurant. And then is there a cost associated with that for the person taking this test to be certified as they, and then if they have to do it every time they change jobs, would they reincur that cost?
Thanks. Co-chairs Greenlink and Thompson, Representative Parrish. This really is about the setting, not the individual. So what we're trying to achieve is that each setting would have two individuals that would actually have had this training so they know what they need to be doing properly within the setting. So we would not really see this as being attached to the individual. We would actually see it being attached to the clinic. In relationship to places like pharmacies, actually, those would be settings that we could actually approve of fairly readily, that they would know how to handle their vaccine, their systems are well in place. So again, it's the clinic that would actually have to be responsible. It's not the individual. And if someone left, we would actually expect that they would have another person trained so that we would have some knowledge that would be there.
Okay, thank you.
Is there a fee?
I'm sorry, thank you. No, there is not going to be a fee.
Representative Thompson?
I guess I'm a little confused because I understood the problem we were trying to correct was a failure of refrigeration and the breakdown and nobody caught it. And I'm not sure how this training program is going to train refrigerators. I mean, I'm familiar with the pharmacy side where logs are kept. Some of them are computerized logs, but at least the ones that are paper logs, there are employee requirements to record that information on a several hour basis. So it sounds to me that if you've got 2,000 people who fell through the cracks on revaccination, somebody wasn't keeping records for a good deal of time to have that many people through the system. And that sounds like a failure of equipment as well as a failure to record data. And some of the equipment part, I don't think you're going to get out by training. So is it training that we need overall, or do we need to line some people up and slap them three times?
Slap the refrigerator.
Yeah, that too, you know.
Chair Thompson, from a quality improvement perspective, we really try and look at what are the systems and what are the issues that are underlying it. With some of the large number of recalls that we've essentially had to do, what will happen is that it is being recorded, it is being tracked, the variability occurs, and nothing is done with the variability. And all of a sudden, a month later, when there's a visit to the clinic and one of our folks reviewing, they see that a month ago that there was actually an outlying temperature read, which means that the doses since then have been subpotent, but children have been administered doses since then. There continues to be a large turnover in population, and the knowledge base really has not been identified. We've also not tied in the accountabilities in a way that really does assure that within a practice. Some practices do a terrific job with that, but even in some of our larger systems, which I think you'll see in the testimony from the Providence healthcare system, and they did a terrific response, that was an indication in one clinic, in one setting, that when they took a look at it, they realized they really had tremendous variability in what was happening, and they put a whole process in place to improve that. So the purpose of the training really is to build in systems, to build in redundancies, to make sure that there's knowledge for understanding what steps to take. It's not really about the equipment per se.
Okay, thank you. Would she make you redundant?
Co-chairs Greenlick and Thompson, almost. My name is Mike Becker with Providence Health and Services, here to testify briefly in regard to support for House Bill 2371. As the committee administrator mentioned, you have before you a letter signed by Margaret Ali, our Division Director for Safety Risk Management, with Providence Medical Group. Unfortunately, she was unable to be here today. She also teaches up at OHSU, so you got me instead. I'm not the subject.
They have you here supporting something.
There you go. Thank you, Chair Co-Chair Greenlee.
I stopped him.
You did. House Bill 2371 does improve vaccine stewardship in the state. It reduces medical errors from the improper storage, handling, and administration of vaccines, and it's essential to ensure effective protection of our patients and citizens of the state. It also provides the ability to standardize and reduce that variability that was noted. Providence Medical Group did have one of the clinics across the state that was identified in May of 2009 for potentially having inconsistent storage and handling of vaccines, thus leading to re-immunization of some children. We took that as a wake-up call and an opportunity to bring standardization to all of our clinics to put in place some best practices. We work closely with the immunization and vaccine management programs to identify what those policies and procedures should be, and then having implemented that learning, we went on to teach other clinics how to identify those practices and improve their own policies and procedures around vaccine handling and immunization, handling of the immunizations and vaccines. We think House Bill 2371 provides important safeguards around staff training, clinic workflows, and will ensure that the issues of 2009 are not repeated. We think the bill is an important protection for the common good and is the right thing to do for our patients. Thank you. I'll take any questions.
Michael, thank you. Did you have a question?
No. I'm scratching my head.
Thank you all very much.
Thank you.
We will close the public hearing on House Bill 2371 and open a public hearing on House Bill 2743. Administrator, you got something for us on that? And do we have any witnesses?
We do. And our able assistant is bringing up word. Mr. Chair, members of the committee, House Bill 2743 is adding podiatric physician and surgeon to the definition of an attending physician for the purposes of a workers' compensation law. You also have a dash one amendment and a hand and gross bill on 2743, and I believe the individual testifying on this bill will be able to explain them.
Mr. Barrows, would you like to join us? We also have an expert around if we need some help as we go along. That's not to say you're not an expert.
No. I think you were accurate the first time. Mr. Chair, members of the committee, I'm Tom Barrows, representing the Oregon Podiatric Medical Association here in support of House Bill 2743, which would return podiatric physicians or doctors of podiatric medicine to attending physician status within the workers' comp system. When the system was reformed in the early 1990s, they didn't have anyone representing them here, and they were sort of forgotten. At the MLAC meeting on Friday, Chair Shiprack was asked about, and I believe he was part of Mahoney Hall Group, why weren't they included, and he said he believed it was inadvertent.
The MLAC endorses?
Mr. Chair, yes, they did.
Thank you. Perhaps you could describe what MLIC is.
Okay, I'm sorry. When the workers' comp systems were formed in, I believe, 1990, a group was set up at the workers' comp division or at the DCBS to be sort of a gatekeeper on workers' comp issues. It's five members represented management, five members represented labor, and issues of workers' comp usually go before them before they come over here. Prior to the reforms, podiatrists saw a relatively few number of patients when they were attending physicians before, and within that, they were relatively low cost. Since the reform, they have patients that get referred to podiatrists have to bounce back and forth between their attending physician and the treating physician podiatrist. This adds cost and delays care. Doctors of podiatric medicine, like MDs and DOs, are a four-year postgraduate degree. The first 2 years mirrors medical school or osteopathy school because podiatrists have full prescription and surgery rights, so they need to know how the whole body works. And then the next 2 years is focused on the foot and ankle. In Iowa, they train side-by-side for the first 2 years with osteopaths. As I said, they perform surgery and they prescribe and are able to treat by any means necessary. They just have a specific scope of practice in a specific region of the body. And along with a few ankle orthopedists, they are the experts in foot and ankle care in the state. Both the Oregon Medical Association and the osteopathic physicians and surgeons have indicated that they're okay with the bill. As I said, MLAC on Friday voted in favor of House Bill 2743, including the amendment. And the amendment is, I'm going to go on record thanking the folks at Workers' Comp because somebody there caught that when we introduced this bill, we left out a piece. In 2007, House Bill 2756 was passed, which created sort of a separate category for a number of providers, including some requirements for training, and that was, we forgot to take that out of this bill. So the amendment simply takes them out of that provision that would be redundant now with the tenured physician status.
Out of a different bill? Out of a different?
A different section, Mr. Chair, yes. That concludes my testimony. Please support the bill. I'd be happy to answer any questions.
Other questions? Tom, walk us through the bill. Where is the change that adds podiatrists to this?
Mr. Chair?
You have the hand engrossed, Tom.
I don't have the hand engrossed. I've just got the...
You have the bill itself?
I've just got the bill itself.
Okay.
Page 2, line 41 and 42, at least on the in the printed bill.
There it is. Thank you. And the dash 1, which deletes it from a different section, not from this section. That's
yes.
65679.
That's correct. I haven't seen the hand engrossed bill, but that my understanding, looking at the amendment and comparing it to the bill, yes, it would take them out of a different section.
And have you heard about any opposition from this?
Mr. Chair, there was a woman who came before MLAC and expressed concern that podiatrists might work outside their scope of practice if this was passed, and I assured the committee that that would not be the case, that nobody was going to put their ticket in jeopardy to work outside the scope. It's very specific. In 1999, the legislature passed a bill that very clearly delineated what the scope of practice for podiatrists is, and so I don't think that's a real concern. That was the only opposition I've heard.
The department's here supporting it if it needs to be supported. All right. Thank you all very much.
Thank you.
I will close the public hearing on 743, and so maybe we'll have a work session along in a bit. And I will open a work session on 2378. We were prepared to move the bill today. I heard some sentiment that we might want to wait. You want to raise that?
I was prepared to move the bill, but I think it is reasonable to understand what the issues are, if there are issues.
What's your interest?
Chairman, it's still early in the process. I don't think it hurts, and I think it's better to have bills thoroughly examined than send them and have things blow up on the floor.
Okay, then let's let's postpone this for maybe about a week, and if you would ask to put it back on as a work session, co-chairs, I'd do it.
Fine, yeah.
And ask the companies to come and tell us why they hate the bill. And
make sure...
My understanding is not a huge issue, so...
It may be a huge issue. But,
Mr. Chair, yes. I would ask that we give OHSU and the transplant folks the ability to explain why they presented that amendment that exempts them, since that seemed to be the sticking point. I think we may not have drilled down quite sufficiently on the reason for that exemption.
Great.
I think that's an excellent idea. But I suspect that's not the sticking point.
I don't think so either.
I think when we hear from the companies, it will be their desire not to be regulated. I mean, the question we would ask them is, if you don't exempt OHSU from this, does that mean they'll support the bill? I don't think.
And, Mr. Chair,
let's find out.
Yeah,
that makes a lot of sense.
Would this be worthy of a work session? Or a work group?
No, let's find out what the issue is and see if there is one. Then we'll see at that point. We can have it scheduled when you have the gavel. I'm saying, Cannon.
Oh, I was surprised not to hear from Representative Sheehan concern about the provision that requires these to be 501c3 nonprofits.
Mm-hmm.
Perhaps Biomed and MedGift are. He indicated that they were fine with the rest of this bill. But my understanding is the bill not only requires them to get licensed with that board, but to be nonprofit entities. And I don't. We'll see if that brings them out as well.
Okay, then I will close the work session on 2378. Ask our administrator to notify folks, and we'll schedule it as soon as it's feasible. We'll open a work session on House Bill 2381. Madam Administrator, what have you got for us on that?
Mr. Co-Chair, members of the committee, House Bill 2381 provides that the state personnel relations law and provisions relating to state financial administration, salaries and expenses of the public employees and administration of public funds apply to the Oregon Board of Optometry, State Board of Massage Therapists, and Physical Therapists Licensing Board. It establishes the fund for the boards in the state treasury and continuously appropriates monies and funds to the boards. This has an emergency clause effective on passage. That is the original bill. What you have before you is the Dash 1 amendments, Mr. Chair, that I believe you spoke to when we had the public hearing. What the Dash 1 amendment does is require those three boards to present the adopted budgets to the governor, the president of the Senate, speakers of the House, legislative fiscal officer, on or before February 1 of odd-numbered years. It also specifies that these boards will apply the state personnel relations laws and provisions relating to salaries and expenses.
And the board still support as amended?
They did, and we received written testimony from them during the public hearing that I believe it's called the Semi-Independent Association. They had that report. They spoke to the amendment, so I believe they were part of developing that amendment. We also, this bill originally had a subsequent referral to Ways and Means. What's included in your information is a fiscal impact on the Dash 1 amendment, which explains that it has with the Dash 1 amendment, this bill has a minimal expenditure impact. And with that, the co-speakers have afforded to the committee the ability to rescind the Ways and Means referral if that is the direction the committee would like to go.
Great. Let's put a motion on the floor. Yes.
Mr. Chair, could you refresh my memory on why these three boards are separate from the other boards? I know there's a reason, but I don't recall what.
No, they just idiosyncratically came up when they were established. Semi-independent.
There's semi-independents that fall into this.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. These are the three semi-independent health boards.
That's good enough.
And we wanted to take away
those three.
And they're happy to do this.
Kind of an odd group.
Yep. Yep.
Yeah. Okay. Thank you.
Motion? Including Dash 1. Let's start with the Dash 1s.
Mr. Chair, I move that we adopt the Dash 1 amendments to House Bill 2381, dated, some date that will be apparent to me in a moment, 2/14/11.
Representative Thompson, I'm
trying to read
the Dash 1 amendments to House Bill 2381. Is there any discussion about the amendment? Is there any objection? Dash 1's accepted. Now the bill, including the subsequent, I mean the motion, including the subsequent.
Sorry.
My motion is being written out as we speak.
Removal.
That much? Okay, Mr. Chair, I move House Bill 2381 as amended to the floor with a DuPras recommendation and rescind the subsequent referral to Ways and Means.
Representative Thompson moves House Bill 2381 as amended with the Dash 1 amendments to the floor. The DuPras recommendation and rescind the subsequent referral to Ways and Means. Any discussion? Please call the roll.
Representative Doherty?
Yes.
Representative Parrish?
Aye.
Representative
Aye.
Representative
Whitner?
Aye.
Co-Vice Chair
Cannon?
Aye.
Co-Vice
Chair Thompson?
Aye.
Co-Chair Greenwood?
Aye.
Motion passes. Co-Chairs allowed me to carry the bill.
Representative or Chair?
Yes, sir.
I think with this being massage therapist, it kind of fits into Representative Parrish's forte a little bit.
Why is he harassing you?
Because
he can't. Thank you, Representative Whitener. Any other business before us?
Mr. Chair?
Yes, sir.
As a clarification, excuse me, I'm losing my voice today. Unless there is some concern on part of the rest of the committee, It's my druthers not to proceed with House Bill 3018, the smoking cessation bill. The problem with that bill that was not foreseen when it was produced is simply that it's going the wrong way.
That's the bill we heard today.
Yes. The intent was to clamp down on people and not let them misuse the smoking cessation programs. It turns out there's good research showing that the successful people in smoking cessation programs often use them 2, 3, and 4 times to get results. So this may be doing exactly the opposite of what was intended. So, you know,
I certainly have no problem.
Okay, I would prefer that we not move it any further than this, unless someone on the committee feels strongly about that.
Okay,
it was an error.
Just a reminder: we're not meeting Friday.
Correct.
We will be meeting Wednesday with Representative Thompson at the control.
Not meeting Friday.
Friday, March 4th is the Dorchester, and yeah. We decided in advance we would
see you in Dorchester.
We would not meet to make it easier.
Yeah,
easier so
it's a party.
Oh yeah.
We can get to Dorchester.
You know that is
some of us.
The city I lived in Boston.
If Arnie's going to be there,
you don't have to be invited. I'm sure you can go and pay your money.
$100.
Oh really? Okay. We're adjourned.
It's a Friday night.